This is World Editor-in-Chief Marvin Olasky. Thanks for being a world member. You make our work possible, and we appreciate your support.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 31st, 2016, and this is The World and Everything in It from member-supported World Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Joseph Slive. Ahead on today's legal docket, Apple versus Samsung at the Supreme Court. Plus, in Iraq, the volunteers providing food and other supplies to frontline fighters in the battle against ISIS.
The goal is to serve the fighters, but also help refugees who were driven out by the Islamic State group, so they can secure the area and return home safe and sound.
In just a moment, a roundup of today's top news.
Can the government choose your church's minister? Can a business refuse to hire you because of your faith practice? Can a school teacher ban the Bible in class? Listen to the First Liberty Briefing to find out the answer to these questions and more. In less than 2 minutes, you'll get an insider's look at the cases shaping religious liberty in America. The First Liberty Briefing looks at the stories that have made America the world's leader in protecting religious liberty. Learn more and subscribe at firstliberty.org/podcast.
Good morning, I'm Kent Covington. The Clinton camp is in crisis management mode with just over a week to go till Election Day after the FBI effectively reopened its investigation into Hillary Clinton's mishandling of classified information. As her campaign scrambles publicly, Clinton is looking to sweep the matter aside. Stumping in Florida Sunday, she called the latest twist in her ongoing email scandal a
noise and distraction.
She urged supporters to focus on the issues and turn out the vote next Tuesday. Her running mate, Virginia Senator Tim Kaine, also downplaying the FBI's announcement.
I think it's now pretty clear that the FBI director doesn't know that there is anything. These could be duplicates of what's already been analyzed. They could be things that don't have anything to do with Hillary Clinton.
While Clinton and Kaine are keeping their poker faces on, many Clinton allies and surrogates are furious, blasting FBI Director James Comey for announcing the rebooted probe.
How is the secretary to defend against this kind of innuendo? So I think it was a terrible mistake.
Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff on ABC's This Week. But Republican rival Donald Trump told a crowd in Las Vegas yesterday, Clinton only has herself to blame.
Hillary set up an illegal server for the obvious purpose of shielding her criminal conduct from public disclosure and exposure.
The FBI made the announcement on Friday after finding Clinton-related emails it had not yet seen on a computer belonging to former New York Congressman Anthony Weiner, the subject of a separate FBI probe. Weiner is the estranged spouse of top Clinton aide Huma Abedin. The FBI probe restart wasn't the only shockwave over the weekend, as Italy was rocked with the strongest earthquake in more than 35 years. World Radio's Jim Henry files this report.
It began by just rattling furniture like this table, but before it was over, the shaking intensified to a 6.6 magnitude earthquake. Centered near Pomezia in central Italy, the strongest in that country since 1980. Buildings weakened from an earlier quake in August, and two aftershocks just last week fell in ruins. Randy Baldwin at the National Earthquake Information Center says he expects damage will be significant.
The villages in the area are very old, and the construction is of a masonry brick-type construction, so they're very susceptible to damage.
The quake injured nearly 20 people, but miraculously, no deaths have been reported. I'm Jim Henry.
For the first time in two centuries, preservation experts have opened what is believed to be Jesus' tomb in Jerusalem. Workers pulled back a marble slab covering the site for 3 days, part of an ongoing restoration and analysis. National Geographic is documenting the restoration work. It reports, quoting here, "The exposure of the burial bed is giving researchers an unprecedented opportunity to study the original surface of what is considered to be the most sacred site in Christianity." A leading climate research center allegedly used stolen research to bag millions of dollars from UK taxpayers. World Radio's Christina Darnell has the story.
The London School of Economics was awarded $11 million through a UK research grant for its Centre for Climate Change Economics and Policy, or CCCEP. Then a report by the Daily Mail revealed that the research was largely plagiarized from researchers unaffiliated with the CCCEP, and in some cases was written before the organization was even founded in 2008. The report also says government funding in the UK is largely dependent on getting positive results, giving researchers a financial incentive to produce data that support the climate change agenda. I'm Christina Darnell.
At the weekend box office, Boo, A Madea Halloween held on to the number one spot.
Happy Halloween.
The Tyler Perry comedy took in another $16 million to bring its box office total to $52 million. The new Tom Hanks action suspense flick Inferno came in a close but disappointing second with $15 million, followed by Jack Reacher and The Accountant. You can find World's reviews of current films along with ratings and content information at WNG.org/movies. I'm Kent Covington. Straight ahead, smartphone giants Apple and Samsung duke it out at the Supreme Court. That's next on the Monday Legal Docket. You're listening to The World and Everything in It.
Get the reliable news you need when and where you want it with the World Radio mobile app.
If your favorite device is with you, World Radio is at your disposal.
You can set the World Radio app to download programs each day automatically and archive your favorite programs to listen to later, ensuring that the wise insights and reliable reporting you value from World don't have to be left at home. To learn more and download, visit WNG.org/World Radio app.
Good morning. You're listening to The World and Everything in It from member-supported World Radio. It's Monday, October 31st. I'm Nick Eicher. The U.S. Supreme Court decided on Friday that it would weigh in on the most current controversy in the moral revolution, the matter of sex-specific changing rooms and restrooms in public schools, and whether boys have the right to enter those reserved for girls and vice versa. It's the so-called transgender bathroom issue. This past May, the Obama administration handed down a new rule on public school bathrooms and dressing rooms. The Justice Department and the Education Department sent letters to public schools in all 50 states with a warning. Allow students to declare a different gender and permit access to sex-segregated facilities and programs, or else risk the loss of federal dollars under Title IX of education law. The Supreme Court case arises out of Gloucester County, Virginia. There, a 17-year-old student, biologically a girl, declared herself a boy. The student had taken hormones to produce a lower voice and facial hair, but had not undergone surgery. The student sued the school district for discrimination and demanded access to the boy's bathroom. A trial court agreed, but the order is now blocked pending this appeal. For its part, the school board in Virginia argues the federal government has overstepped its authority, saying a change to Title IX rules requires notice and comment before taking effect. Moreover, the board argues the rule fails to take into account the privacy and safety concerns of other students. Argument in this case is likely sometime after late February. Well, this week, the Supreme Court will hear five oral arguments. Today, a report on a landmark patent case that pits two smartphone giants against one another. It's Apple versus Samsung. Here is World Radio legal affairs correspondent Mary Reichert.
The last time the Supreme Court reviewed the tiny slice of patent law involved here was 120 years ago, dating back perhaps to the time of this early recording.
You are a body part.
Three years ago, the Smithsonian made this recording available to the public. It's, of course, the voice of the inventor of the first telephone, Alexander Graham Bell. His 1876 invention sparked years of legal wrangling over the patent rights. And when you think of a patent, what's likely to come to mind is technology, like the phone, or medications like drugs to fight heart disease, even a machine to press water out of tofu. Inventors naturally want to protect their ideas by securing a patent on how something they thought of works. But in this case, we're talking about patents on designs, and design patents are different. Here's a bit of important history. In the 19th century, the courts were filled with disputes among inventors with patents and the people who copied off their ideas. They jousted over the designs of things like spoon handles, saddles, cast iron stoves, and carpets. The infringed wanted money damages from the infringers of their designs. Today, the jousting continues over essentially the thing Alexander Graham Bell started in 1876, but the combatants happen to be the two top smartphone manufacturers in the world, Apple and Samsung. The law involved, both now and in the 1800s, hasn't changed much. It says that whoever uses the patented design on any article for purpose of sale is liable to the patent owner to the extent of his total profit. And that's the crucial phrase, total profit. Lawyer Kathleen Sullivan represented the South Korean company Samsung.
A smartphone is smart because it contains hundreds of thousands of the technologies that make it work.
A jury found Samsung guilty of infringing on three designs of Apple's iPhone: the black glass face, the rectangle shape with rounded rims, and its circular home button and multicolored display of icons. For those three violations, Samsung was ordered to pay nearly $1 billion in damages. Again, lawyer Sullivan for Samsung.
That result makes no sense. A single design patent on the portion of the appearance of a phone should not entitle the design patent holder to all the profit on the entire phone.
Why, Sullivan asked, should Apple get all Samsung's profits on phones that only used a few of Apple's designs? The jury ought to have been told to narrow their focus. After all, smartphones are not as simple as a spoon handle. Justice Anthony Kennedy jumped in with an analogy involving a popular car. Just how do you separate out the design of something from its other aspects?
One way.
Suppose you had a case where it's a stroke of genius, the design. In 2 days, they come up with a design. Let's assume the Volkswagen Beetle analogy that some of the briefs refer to. Suppose the Volkswagen Beetle design was done in 3 days, and it was a stroke of genius, and it identified the car. Then it seems to me that that's quite unfair to say, well, we give 3 days profit, but then it took 100,000 hours to develop the motor.
Well, Your Honor, here's what we would do with the Beetle.
She would go on to explain that evidence of design value could come from accounting principles, and they'd be used to back up any claims for damages. But Apple's lawyer, Seth Waxman, argued the law is on his side. Waxman said his client spent lots and lots of money developing those very designs. And you just can't separate out the phone's design the way you could separate out, say, a microphone or a battery in a smartphone.
But a design is not a component. A design is applied to a thing, and the jury has to decide, in the case of the VW Beetle, that you have either a cup holder or a patented hubcap or the iconic shape of the car. I think that a jury would very well conclude that because someone who sees the iconic shape of a VW Beetle and buys it thinks that they are buying the Beetle, that is, after all, the reason why the infringer copied it.
Justice Samuel Alito was having a hard time with that. Consumers buy products for all sorts of reasons, any one of which might be called the article of manufacture. That's patent language.
This hypothetical is not helpful to me because I can't get over the thought that nobody buys a car, even a Beetle, just because they like the way it looks. What if it, you know, it cost, I think, $1,800 when it was first sold in the United States? What if it cost $18,000? What if it got 2 miles per gallon? What if it broke down every 50 miles? So if that is a real question, if it is a real question whether the article of manufacture there is the design or the entire car, it gives me pause about the test for determining what is the article of manufacture.
But Justice Elena Kagan thought that in some cases, looks really do make the biggest difference.
Let's take a case, and I think that the VW example is a good example for this reason, where the thing that makes the product distinctive does not cost all that much. There's not been a lot of input. Somebody, just some engineer or some graphic artist or whatever, woke up one day and said, I just have this great idea for an appearance. But that's the principal reason why the product has been successful. I mean, the car has to run, and it has to do all the other things that cars do. But the principal reason why the car has been successful has to do with this particular appearance, the design.
Just how to put a dollar value on looks in a damages case is a puzzle. Justice Kennedy to Samsung lawyer Sullivan.
It seems to me neither side gives us an instruction to work with. Both parties kind of leave it up in the air and say, oh, give it to the jury. If I were the juror, I simply wouldn't know what to do under your test.
Samsung Sullivan suggested a two-pronged test. Decide the specific thing covered by the patent design, and then figure out the profit tied to just that aspect. But that old patent law itself does not allow for apportioning damages that way. Chief Justice John Roberts got into this tussle with Apple's lawyer Waxman.
Maybe I'm not grasping the difficulties in the case. It seems to me that the design is applied to the exterior case of the phone. It's not applied to all the chips and wires. So
that's right. That's absolutely right. And, you know, of course, you can't get a design patent on something that the consumer can't see. And yet Congress...
There shouldn't be profits awarded based on the entire price of the phone.
No, the profits are awarded on the article of manufacture to which the design is applied.
The case part of it.
Well, maybe and maybe not. I think the difficulty here is that it's important to understand that design is not a component, and the patented design is not the article of manufacture. The patented design is something that's applied to an article of manufacture.
Okay, well, the chips and all are articles of manufacture, right? How is the design of the case applied to those chips?
Arguing on behalf of the federal government was Brian Fletcher of the U.S. Department of Justice. He argued for another way to attach worth to a particular aspect of an item, like looks.
So supposing that we've decided that the bug, the relevant article in the bug is just the body of the bug.
Exactly.
Then I think the question is, the best way to determine that, at least that I can think of right now, would be consumer surveys addressed to what extent are people who buy bugs making their purchasing decisions based on the look of the car, and to what extent are they instead valuing other things.
This case was argued, coincidentally, the same day Samsung executives yanked the Galaxy Note 7 smartphone from the market because some of them burst into flames. Most observers seem to agree that current law overcompensates patent holders when they get total profits from complex products like smartphones. Samsung's lawyer asked, at the very least, for the Supreme Court to remand the case with whatever new standard the court devises that's fairer than the current law. However the court decides, it's difficult to know how consumers will feel the effects, namely price and choice, but the balance between protecting design patents versus stifling innovation in technology is always a concern. The court will likely craft new guidance for the lower courts to follow and then remand accordingly as Samsung wants. So I predict a narrow win for Samsung. On the legal docket for World Radio, I'm Mary Reichard.
Of wisdom in your child's life. Children are exposed to tens of thousands of media messages a week, influencing the way they think and act, competing for their allegiance. God's Big World, World Kids, and World Teen are safe and fun tools that provide them healthy pathways to ask, learn, and grow, pointing them to the kind of life God intends. Get the tools your kids need at wng.org/children.
Next, the Monday Money Beat on World Radio, news about business, the markets, and the economy. Friday's report on the nation's third quarter gross domestic product showed quite a bit of improvement over reports earlier in the year. The Commerce Department pegged GDP growth at 2.9%. That's more than twice the rate of the second quarter. But even so, the average annual growth rate since the last recession ended in 2009 has been just 2.1%, the slowest expansion since the late 1940s. A mixed week in the stock markets last week, the Dow Jones Industrials posted a slight gain and the S&P 500 a 0.75% loss. The NASDAQ Composite was down about 1.25%. That last largely was due to tech trouble. Apple was down 2.5% for the week as the company reported its first annual revenue decline in 15 years. Amazon shares fell 5% after the online retailer missed earnings estimates. And Twitter announced a $100 million loss in the third quarter. The company also said it is cutting 9% of its workforce and shutting down its once highly popular looping video app, Vine. More mergers, Qualcomm and NXP Semiconductors are getting hitched. Also, Rockwell Collins and BE Aerospace, Groupon and Living Social, and brokerage firms TD Ameritrade and Scottrade. And the Wall Street Journal reported that General Electric is in talks to merge its oil and gas business with Baker Hughes. And here's some good news. Federal authorities have shut down a scheme perpetrated by scamsters in the U.S. and India who bilked thousands of Americans out of hundreds of millions of dollars by posing as IRS and Department of Homeland Security officials. Earlier this month, you may remember, we reported that Indian authorities had arrested 70 people in India in connection with the scheme. Now 20 people have been rounded up in the U.S. According to an indictment made public late last week, callers in India phoned people in the U.S. demanding that they make immediate payments to clear unpaid taxes or risk arrest. The stateside conspirators would then collect the victims' funds, launder them, and transfer them to India. U.S. federal investigators say the scheme had been in operation for 4 years. On the financial calendar this week, as October gives way to November, both the Bank of England and the Bank of Japan will announce interest rate decisions. Here in the U.S., the Fed meets and is likely, according to most analysts, to hold rates steady. Company earnings reports continue to pour forth. Numbers this week from Alibaba, CBS, Hyatt Hotels, Lowe's, Occidental Petroleum, Qualcomm, Revlon, U.S. Steel, and Starbucks. And on Friday, the Labor Department releases employment and unemployment numbers for October. And that's today's Money Beat. Someone once said that an army marches on its stomach. That was either Napoleon, Frederick the Great of Prussia, or perhaps Roman army physician Claudius Galen. No one knows for sure, but regardless, the idea is that soldiers have to eat to have the strength and the energy to fight. As you know from the news, in Iraq, military forces, some 100,000 strong, are engaged in battles to retake Mosul and surrounding areas in northern Iraq from the Islamic State. Shiite militias are taking part in those battles against ISIS. That may turn out to be a very good thing for Iraq's ongoing relations between Shiites and Sunnis. We'll have to wait to see. For now, we're just going to focus on how those militias are being supplied with food and other provisions. In traditional military situations, such considerations are handled by logistics officers. But with Shiite militias supplying the troops is a volunteer community effort. A quick bit of background. In June 2014, the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, perhaps the most revered Shiite cleric in the country, urged Iraqis to take up arms against ISIS. That led to the emergence of the Hashed al-Shabi, or in English, the Popular Mobilization, a mix of volunteers and pre-existing Shiite militias that has since played a key role in pushing back the jihadists. Now, as the battle for Mosul goes forward and Shiite militias are at the front, Shiite volunteers are preparing thousands of meals every day for the troops. They're delivering some of that food to Iraq's regular troops, but also to their own, the men of the Hashed al-Shabi. Riyad al-Atabi is one of the volunteers. He's a 42-year-old car dealer who left his wife and children in Baghdad to spend a week about 15 miles behind the front lines preparing food for the fighters.
We start at 5 in the morning and finish at midnight. Our convoy stays 10 days. As soon as one convoy leaves, another arrives. We all cook for the Hashed.
The road leading to the front is crowded with cars filled with food. The cars come from many places in the central and southern parts of Iraq, including Basra, Karbala, and Baghdad. The convoys deliver not only food and water, but also clothes and more. Soldier Hussein Ali.
As you can see, we're on the front line, and we have underwear, shoes, scarves, hats. They bring us everything, food, drinks, all types of meat or fish, everything, even phone chargers.
This man, Abu Ali al-Aki Ali, is in charge of a convoy heading to Fishka, a town south of Mosul. He says helping serve the fighters is also helping serve the refugees who had to flee their homes to escape ISIS.
The goal is to serve the fighters, but also help refugees who were driven out by the Islamic State group, so they can secure the area and return home safe and sound.
The volunteers say this massive delivery operation is financed entirely by private donations. And according to a report from the French press agency, some Hashed fighters say they're better stocked than even the official Iraqi soldiers. Later this week, we'll have much more about the battle for Mosul and about Christian refugees who hope they soon can return to their homes in northern Iraq.
This is Kevin Martin, CEO of World News Group. If life really is short and full of trouble, it's no wonder we always have bad news to report. But with the world and everything in it, along with World's other news channels, we want to make sure the good news is always part of the news. That doesn't mean we tell only happy stories, but it does mean that there's a bigger story to every small story, and that big story ends very well indeed. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to The World and Everything in It from World Radio, and it's time for The History Book, our look back at some of what has happened during this week in history. Here's Paul Butler.
We begin today with November 2nd, 1920.
This is KDKA of the Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
The first commercial licensed radio station in the U.S. begins broadcasting from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This is a reenactment of its first broadcast.
We'd appreciate it if anyone hearing this broadcast would communicate with us, as we are very anxious to know how far the broadcast is reaching and how it is being received.
KDKA goes on to pioneer many programs that become standard radio offerings. Live musical performances, broadcast news, sporting events, and situation comedies. KDKA's broadcast from Pittsburgh's Calvary Episcopal Church is the earliest example of Christian programming on the radio. That weekly program ran for nearly 40 years and is one of the longest-running religious programs in broadcast history. Next, November 1st, 1979. The Ayatollah Khomeini urges Iranians to protest American attempts to hinder an Iranian revolution, as well as President Jimmy Carter's recent decision to allow Iran's former Shah to come to the States for medical treatment. 3 days later, on November 4th, what begins as a sit-in of a few hundred students from Tehran University turns into a militant uprising, as protesters seize control of the U.S. Embassy, taking 90 hostages. 63 are Americans.
About 500 Iranian youth continue to occupy the embassy compound here in Tehran, while close to 2,000...
A few days later, one of the hostages is brought out blindfolded, described here in an ABC evening newscast.
He was turned to face reporters and cameramen and several hundred Iranian demonstrators outside the embassy's gates. "Yankee, go home," they cried, but they made no attempt to harm him.
11 of the hostages are soon released, but 52 Americans remain held as negotiations drag on between the U.S. and Iran. 5 months after the hostage drama begins, an American military attempt to rescue the captives fails, resulting in the hostages being split up, making another single rescue attempt impossible.
The mission on which they were embarked was a humanitarian mission. It was not directed against Iran. It was not directed against the people of Iran.
Finally, after 444 days of captivity, the hostages are released, just hours after new American President Ronald Reagan delivers his inaugural address. And finally, November 2, 2003. The U.S. Episcopal Church consecrates its first openly homosexual bishop, Gene Robinson, during a three-hour ceremony at the University of New Hampshire Sports Arena. 4,000 people attend the event, including some who object to Robinson's installation.
It breaks my heart to be here. My name is Earl Fox, and I thank the Diocese of New Hampshire and all of you folks here for being willing to listen to us. Whatever else homosexuality may be, it is at least a behavior. We are forbidden to judge persons, and yet required to judge behavior. It would thus be reasonable to inquire into the nature of such behavior for which approval is sought.
The consecration of Robinson intensifies the growing division within the Episcopal Church and the worldwide Anglican Communion over the issue of homosexuality. For more than a decade now, leaders in the Anglican Communion have been trying to prevent schism. Earlier this year, Anglican leaders placed restrictions on Episcopal Church involvement in Anglican Communion decision-making. Since Robinson's consecration in 2003, overall Sunday attendance at Episcopal worship services in the U.S. has declined nearly 30%. And many conservative Episcopalians have moved to a new denomination, the Anglican Church in North America. That's this week's look into the World Radio History Book. I'm Paul Butler.
World Radio produces The World and Everything in It. We are a nonprofit news team committed to honest reporting from a biblical worldview perspective. That's our program for Monday. Thanks so much for listening. And we'd be grateful if you'd encourage others to listen too. As a World member, you can help us spread the word about our complimentary 3-month trial membership. It provides full access to this program, as well as access to World Digital and World Magazine, all at no charge for 3 full months. Your friends and family members can sign up with no obligation at this website, getworldnow.com. Getworldnow.com. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Joseph Slive. On tomorrow's program, The Identity Crisis of America's Religious Right. We hope you can join us for The World and Everything in It.